We haven't been in the habit of chanting this gatha before talking, and it adds a little bit to the it ups the ante, so to speak. And then to film the whole thing and tape it, so all of a sudden I have the feeling I have to say something special or so. First, I would like to welcome Yoshiko.
Yoshi.
Wonderful that you can be here. It is exactly today, 10 years ago, and just about this time of the day, in the early afternoon. That our beloved friend and teacher, together with his daughter Maya, passed on. July 26, 2002. Michael put on the invitation that the theme of our gathering, of our being together, is I think remembering the teachings of Kobun. In many ways, Kobun's teaching was really a non-teaching, a no-teaching. It seems he encouraged whatever there was, and whatever people's aspiration or inspiration, he tried to support as good as he could. And his capacity to support, even sort of slightly, by normal standards, slightly crazy inspirations or aspirations, he seemed to support anyway. Of course, he taught us in a tradition, in a lineage. He taught us very specific things, like how to sit, zazen, the posture. One of the things I remember very clearly, very often doing kinhin, he would actually walk up to people and adjust their posture during kinhin. Oh. Like he did in Dokusan quite often, when people asked specific questions about something and he would listen. And I would translate, that's how I know, because I was in the room there translating. And then he would just, his answer was to go and either just on the mudra, fiddle around with the hands and the thumbs, or get up and adjust the posture. Pretty physical things, actually. Mostly physical things, I noticed. And I understand in the earlier days, which a lot of you knew him, when I did not know him yet, he was really teaching ceremonies and studying certain texts. By the time I met him, or we connected, there wasn't much of that. He didn't do much of that. I remember once somebody asking him, are you a Soto Zen priest? And he thought for a while and said, yes, I'm a Soto Zen priest. And then he thought again a little bit, and then he said, well, maybe it would be better or more correct to say that I'm a Buddhist priest. Making it a little bit wider. And then he thought again and said, maybe better to say that I'm a human being. But he didn't even stop at that. He said, actually, if I look closely, I'm not so sure. He said, maybe some kind of strange alien or... So, when we honestly look closely, and Sesshin is a good time to look closely, because one has to have a certain stillness and a certain openness and a certain freedom to actually acknowledge in a deep way the fact that we don't know anything, that we really don't know who we are or what we are doing here. I mean, of course we know many things, and as we have grown older, we have developed personality and skills and networks of relationships, and which is very important, and which we have to tend to and take care of carefully and as good as we can. But somehow this is surface. Somehow we know that this is not really our home. We are this, what we are, but tentatively, or just very temporary. When I drove down from Green Gulch yesterday, Sister Theresia, our Franciscan and Zen nun, told me a little story which I liked a lot. In heaven the angels were all singing hallelujah and having a good time. And one angel didn't really sing hallelujah and seemed to be a little bit bothered. So I guess some archangel or so came, or maybe even God herself, came and said, well, what's the matter with you, you know, there's something wrong. And she said, no, everything is fine, everything is perfect, except I can't forget those people on the earth, those suffering beings that I can't forget them. I really would like to help them, be with them. So the angel's wish got granted, and there he or she woke up as a homeless person in the streets, behind the garbage, and then this person would live his or her life, and at night she would look up at the stars and remember her mission or her true home. I think this resonates very closely to our idea of a bodhisattva, that we in this earth, in this life, we remember, try to remember that we are bodhisattvas, that this is really our aspiration, that what brought us to this, into this life again, was the vow to help or to save all beings. If we have to put a label on it, if we have to, and we have to, give us some idea of what we're doing, this seems to be by far the best of all possibilities. So that's the reason we do, like, to remember, we take refuge to Buddha and Dharma and Sangha. On Saturday, we will have the joyous occasion of having a ordination ceremony, where together, of course, one specific person does it, but together we remind ourselves what our true mission is on this planet. So much seems to be a question of balance in this life, that we keep a balance of, it's not a static balance, it's always going back and forth, and at different times balance means a different thing for us. When we are young, we probably have to work hard to become somebody, make a life, to cut out a life, and to find our corner in this big universe. But even then, already it is important to not forget, not to get too trapped by the intention to be somebody, to make something. Of course, our generation, I speak for myself and those in my age group, we many of us approached it the other way around. We were young hippies and we took something, some medicine or some molecules, and all of a sudden we did not only remember, but we were this other thing. We this completely free, open spirit that had no boundaries and had no particularly tied to anything, and that for some of us was so overwhelming that we sort of threw away that life that we were carefully schooling and building, and then it took some time, like practice, to put ourselves together again. The pieces that we just threw away, and hopefully put them together in a more sane or more healthy way. But and now that we are getting up there slowly, maybe the challenge is how to fall apart gracefully again. Obviously, we lived sort of the challenge is to neither go too strong in one way nor to the other. To do what we have to do with complete attention and with the feeling of like doing it forever, you know, to work in a place like this that will be for 500 years, this will be a practice place, and we have to take care of it as with all our best intentions as we can. And at the same time, we have to sort of, it's like building a rock garden on a landslide, you know, while the whole thing is rushing down already, a big avalanche, and we pile a few stones on top of each other. We need some kind of stability in this life to find meaning and some measurement of happiness and ease. So we need relationships that last, that we can work on. But at the same time, knowing that this is just a very tentative, very temporary likely to change any minute or any second, unexpectedly sometimes. Ready to let it go any time. It's a challenging endeavor that we have set out. In some ways, it's much easier to say, well, I just concentrate on my career, and I just I think also, of course, for like what we do here, the Soto Zen tradition that we keep alive and that we try to establish. I don't know if we try to, but we seem to do it. We have to also try to do it very carefully, with respectfully, but also lightly, to be ready or interested to let it change. So I'm very happy also to see that even in this one lineage that we are in, Koben's lineage, there's different people do different things. Some do it a little bit more traditional, some do it less traditional. Some wear robes, more formal, and some don't wear robes at all. And they probably carry the spirit just as authentic as the other more formal ones. And Koben really did encourage us to be free in that way. He did teach me things in ceremonies when I asked him some detail, but he also said, you know, you offer some incense and you make three bows, and at the end you also make three bows, and in the middle basically you make it up, you know? It's all made up anyway. And I find this kind of tension is very interesting, you know, not to just completely throw it out and say, you know, this is some Japanese thing, to play around that edge a little bit is, I find this interesting and helpful. When I once asked him, once we were preparing, actually we were preparing, among other things, the papers of Shōhō, and it was a ceremony, so we did chukai, and we did papers for priest ordination. And so I asked him, what is the difference between a priest and a layperson? And he thought a while, at his usual pause of thinking, and then he said, no difference. And he added, we priests are a little bit weaker, so we need more crutches and props. And some of you have already told that story when I was giving a lecture once, and I forgot where it was, but and why I was talking and he was sitting. Sometimes he asked me to talk when he didn't feel like talking. In that respect, I feel like I'm a true heir of Koben, that talking is always sort of a little bit not exactly my favorite thing. So somebody asked what a priest is, you know, and I started out with explaining that you become a priest if you go through a certain ceremony, and then you sew your case, and then you shave your head, and then you. At which point, very unusual to him, he interrupted me, which he basically doesn't do, and said something like, very flat. He said, if you are ready to serve your community, then you are a priest. And if you are not, you are not. Regardless whether you went through ceremonies or not, and whether you know the ropes, etc. See the Dharma chant again. Of course, it has two sides to it. Yeah. To hear the truth of the Tathagata's words, it's just that, you know, if we read some holy scriptures or hear some brilliant or insightful person, it's easier to hear, but it's basically also the main responsibility is on the hearer. If you are open to hear, we hear the pure Dharma, certainly in the song of the birds or the wind, but even in the telephone book, if you read it down, you hear the Dharma, and see all these human people that are there. In every trash can, you know, if you're open, if you're there, you hear it, you see it. So we make special events, or special. To build a sendo basically is completely unnecessary. It's ridiculous in some ways, but still we have to build sendos, and we have to make special occasions where to remind ourselves, to bring ourselves back to the here and now, and that's the only place we can ever enter. If we really are here, if we are past or future, lost in our thoughts, which seems to be the main place we get lost, it seems to be that is our crown and our shakya, our prison. We are the beings on this planet that can think best. We can extract ourselves from where we are and look at our from the outside, so to speak. And that has given us dominion over many things, over this planet. But so this is a wonderful thing that we can think in this. It's as wonderful as our hearing and our smelling and touching. But it seems like more than the other senses, we get so fascinated by it, we get so attracted to it, we are so fascinated by the content of our thinking that we forget that we are thinking. We think that's what we are. We identify with it. And then we identify with it and we get attached to it. And then you suffer. So this is a really wonderful practice that we have, this just sitting, this shikantaza we call it. To cultivate a mind that is wide enough, a mind that is wide enough to, so that easily, without any problems, pleasant and unpleasant things have space. That it can encompass, that it can hold and allow the ups and downs of our lives. And to remember the container in which all of this is happening. Not to identify too much with the single pieces in it. I didn't feel so good after yesterday, after I talked about Doku-san, that I wasn't... I would love to talk to each one of you, but really the main... I felt more important to stay in the sangha with you. But please, if you really want to talk to me, don't hesitate. Let me know. We'll let Shwesta Theresia know, and then she will, if you can catch her easier than me, tell her, and she will tell me, and we'll somehow get together. Maybe you want to ask or say something now. Maybe you have something that we can share together.
So if there's no difference between a priest and not a priest, then why become a priest?
The ancient question. If we are already enlightened beings, Buddhas, why do we have to practice? If we are already here, why do we have to come back to here? It seems like because we have bodies, because we have a physical existence, we have to be something. So, you know, we are all born naked, one could say, and why not stay naked, but it seems like we have to all take on some identity. And being a layperson or not a priest is just as much as a decision as being a priest or doing it seems like all cultures have that kind of job or profession or character in some ways. That seems to be one of the roles that exist in society. Like passages have to be acknowledged in all traditions, you know, when somebody gets born, when you become an adult, when you die, you do something. Usually some people are in charge of doing that or organizing that. But, so it certainly wasn't my intention when I was a young man. I never would have guessed, or and it just happens somehow. And I question myself again and again. And when I told Coben I was already living in Austria, and this is a very rural situation and farmers, and this really, I felt, separates me from the people. And I said to Coben, I think maybe I shouldn't wear my robes for at least a while. And he said, yeah, that's okay. And then he gave me a brown robe. And just about when I was ready to take a sabbatical, something, he passed on. Then I was stuck again. I took a sabbatical then a few years later. And he told me, you know, you don't just quit, you go and retreat. You don't quit, you go and retreat. It can be a long retreat. You can go for years and years, but you stay with it. And I think it's very healthy that the non-priests keep poking, asking a little bit. What are you doing? Why are you doing?
Yes, I have this question about, well, when someone becomes a priest, then usually there is a training. What do you think? What kind of training needs someone who becomes a priest?
I just, you know, we put together a book on Coben. It's in the library. Actually, I used your opportunity to encourage you, if you have not written anything for the book, the book is basically a collection of people remembering Coben. So whatever they had to say or think, or they could write. And so please, if you, for some reason or another, haven't had a chance to write anything, please write it down and send it to me, and we'll make another, it will be a second printing, and then we can include it. So, but that one of the, I'm just reading it myself, I didn't read all the incoming things yet. And one person that did not get ordained by, I guess, Reb, because Reb asks you to stay with him for 5 years and study, and somebody suggested maybe Coben will ordain you. So that person did go to Coben, and he agreed. And he said, and explicitly said, I will ordain you, but I will not train you. The training you have to organize yourself. That's sort of a koan. Really, the real training is our life. If we can see our life and what happens to us, and inside and outside, that is the real training. And if we can see it as training, if we can take everything that we meet as a challenge to whatever, to be grateful, or to become more free, or to have a deeper understanding, or more compassion. All these things that we, in our best moments, we know that's the direction we want to go in. So our life really is the training. But because we forget that, we have to make special training, you know, learn special skills. Priest training has all, you know, you have to do a funeral. It's good to know a little bit how could one do a funeral, or get a few tools that one can use. It's like you know, if you study psychology or so, if you become a therapist, you learn skills, you learn tools to how to deal with things that a medical doctor works with physical thing, you know, if his finger is broken, how you can get it straight again and so forth. And I guess this is also true in one can get more skillful in helping, beginning with oneself and then extending it also to other people. In some way also you just make yourself like a target. You put up this little flag and say, I'm game. if you really need, I've set myself up to, I've made a vow to try to be there for you. And also the other side is true. Kogan often talked about your case like a shield that protects you from this maybe our ozone layer becomes thinner and all kinds of deadly rays come in and so forth. So maybe this is also some kind of protection from the harmful energies that are in the world. It's just one thing to work with or to work on. That you can pick a relationship is another one that definitely is an unsolvable, but challenging and rewarding and very lively way to study oneself.
Another question. So, but when it was said this morning that Kobun Roshi ordained everyone who wanted to be ordained.
That's not true. He refused some. Completely, I have no understanding what that was all about. Because one person apparently he did different things in different times of his life. By the time he came to Europe, he was already, that was the last 15 years of his life, and he just ordained everybody, or encouraged everybody. And I remember one person, I said, Kobun, I really do not feel good. He always asked me to do the ordinations. In Europe, he didn't ordain people. He asked me to do it. So I said, I really don't feel good about ordaining this person because he or she does it for all the wrong reasons, as far as I can tell. And so he said, okay, then I will ordain. Which didn't feel make me feel so good. And then the time was set and everything. And as we walk into the sendo, he pushes me ahead and said, "You ordain." And as it turned out, she turned out really nice. It was a little bumpy for a while, and for all the wrong reasons, you know, puffed up and being an important person. But then, over the years, it turned out quite all right.
How do you train for death?
How do I train?
For death.
For death.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Don Juan, some of you know, Castaneda, says that death is always sitting on his left shoulder and is a very good advisor. So whatever he does, he also views under the aspect of finality or of passing on. For me personally, I have had a few experiences that when I get very sick, I'm not sick very often, but like every other year, I get really sick. And it goes very quick, usually 2 days or so. But those 2 days, I lose a lot of weight and I sweating and God knows what. And then sort of laying there, just sort of stuffed nose and stuff, everything, and just the breathing in and out, I feel like that gets very close there. And when I watch people that are dying, you know, they're usually dry mouth, and then there's just breathing going on and uncomfortable. And then I thought, well, then maybe that's how it probably feels. I think to live as full as we can is probably the best preparation for dying.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, nobody ever came back, so we don't know. You can prepare to a certain degree, but at some point one has to jump into the water if one wants to swim, and there's no, in this case, no coming back. So I'm very happy, survived another lecture with your kind support, and thank you very much for all being here and being patient and doing your thing. We get another chance. Thank you very much.